Let me introduce our last speaker of the day, last but not least, Mrs. Randy Engel. Mrs. Engel founded the U.S. Coalition for Life in 1972 and has testified numerous times before the U.S. Senate and House committees and hearings on life issues. She's authored three books. We have several of them, I think. And I hope all of you have picked up the literature that was here on the front table for her speak. Randy's also written extensively on population control, sexual conditioning, eugenic abortion, euthanasia, and on federal and foundation anti-life intimidations and programs. Randy and her husband are the parents of five children and grandparents of six. Please welcome Mrs. Randy Engel.
Thank you very much, Eleanor, for the opportunity to speak.
Do you want to stand up taller?
Oh, yes, that'd be fine. I just have to remember I'll be on a stand.
These grandmas.
Okay. That's fine. How is that out there? Good? Good. First of all, let me thank Eleanor for her kind invitation to come out. I was excited about coming out for a number of reasons. One, because Eleanor has always been so wonderful to the Michael Fund, the International Foundation for Genetic Research, which I head. That's the pro-life alternative to the March of Dimes. My second reason was that I was fortunate enough to be able to have my daughter, my daughter Dawn, and our wonderful little grandchild, Jessica, with us today. And it was strange because I asked Dawn, my own daughter, I believe has never heard me give a talk in 30 years. So Dawn, are you here? She hasn't made it yet. Okay. There's a wonderful story about an old Irish couple, parents of a very large family. And they were asked one evening to come to a reception for a priest from the local parish. This priest had gone to Rome. He had received a degree in the theology of the family and was very excited to share his newfound knowledge with the members of his old parish. So on the way home, the husband turned to his wife and said, "Peg of my heart, did you understand everything that the good father said tonight?" And she said, "No, not everything. Some things, yes, but not everything." And then he turned to her and said, "Peg of my heart, just tell me this. Have we ever had conjugal relations?" And she said to him, after some thought, "No, I don't think so. At least they never showed up at your pa's funeral." I like to tell that for a little bit of levity because unfortunately there's very little to laugh about in the topic which you are about to hear. The issue of so-called sex education is no laughing matter. In the words of my old colleague, Dr. Melvin Anschel, a psychiatrist, California psychiatrist, and a prominent critic of classroom sex education, so-called, "Such programs are far from comical, they are tragic. They are anti-God, anti-family, anti-civilized, and anti-human. It is not education in the true sense of the word. In fact, it is not educational at all. It is anti-educational. That is why the term sex education should never be stated without the term so-called to qualify it. In order to see the issue clearly, we have to begin by looking at the term itself. We have to get rid of semantic fog. And once we get rid of semantic fog, we can give anti-life concepts their proper name. Because in any warfare, and we are engaged in warfare against Western civilization and Christianity. In any warfare, verbal stratagem is as essential as tactical stratagem. The proper name for so-called sex education is Pavlovian conditioning, brainwashing, if you will. It's a form of psychological rape designed to alter the beliefs, attitudes, values, and behaviors of students in the sexual sphere in order to prepare the youth's assimilation into the new totalitarianism. Sometimes it's called the new biocracy. Sometimes it's referred to as the new world order. In his classical work, What's Wrong with Sex Education?, Dr. Anschel identifies sex classroom instruction as being responsible for the widespread dissemination of youthful moral consciences and the production of affectionless robots capable of, quote, engaging in all sex acts with indifference and without guilt, the characteristics of pimps and prostitutes. This information comes as no surprise for those who have studied the issue for years. More than 25 years ago, an English psychiatrist, wife and mother by the name of Louise Eichhoff, conducted a study on the origins of changes in female juvenile delinquents, specifically a study of the nature of female offenders between the ages of 12 and 17, before, which would be the period around the 1950s, and after 1970s, the introduction of so-called sex education into the British educational system. As in the United States, this explicit sexual instruction was introduced into the British system, both secondary and primary schools, ostensibly, and notice the word ostensibly, to promote family life and prevent venereal disease transmission. The title was given Human Biology. The Ministry of Education, mistaking parents' reticence regarding sexual matters for negligence, gave the order that all elementary and secondary schools begin systematic, explicit education beginning at the earliest years. This is the profile that Dr. Eichhoff came out with. In 1950, the school-age offender shared the following characteristics. Their delinquent behavior was responsible to some very specific tragedy within the family unit, and sometimes simply destitution. The offenders were largely ignorant of the law and the nature of the crime that they had committed. The crimes were fairly simple, including truancy, and related to minor infractions of the law. Their crimes were unplanned. They normally acted alone. None of the offenders were involved in any way sexually. Therefore, there was no case of venereal disease, no abortions, no out-of-wedlock pregnancies. They had normal physiological composition. The offenders exhibited great modesty so that when questioned, officers had to approach the issue of sex in a manner which was declared to be delicate. They had received adequate instruction in terms of personal hygiene, normally from their mother. And the overall writing characteristics of these young ladies was that they were contrite when they were apprehended. They were grateful to those who were trying to help them, and they were open to assistance. By 1970, after more than a decade of explicit sexual instruction, This same school received an entirely new category of young female offenders. These delinquents were not in any way connected to unsatisfactory home situations. Their crimes were now of a very grave nature, in other words, adult crimes. Their crimes were planned and carried out with full knowledge of the law. The offenders invariably were involved in some sexual relationship and viewed it as their right. When apprehended, they were defiant and not contrite. They showed themselves to be outside the range of parental authority, a resented authority in general. Their behavior was manifested by adult actions, but emotionally they were crippled. The girls were self-centered, unable to love, sought out sex for sex's sake, and were subject to tantrums when frustrated. Needless to say, there was also now the issue of venereal disease, abortion, out-of-wedlock pregnancies, something totally unknown to the virginal young women of the 1950s. Escott attributed this difference to the interference in the normal maturation process of these girls, who were prematurely sexually awakened by explicit sexual knowledge given in the classroom. In other words, adult behavior was stimulated, even though these were in fact still children. The action of so-called presenting sex education in the school, she found to be contrary both to nature and to all civilized societies in which such information is generally reserved to after, not before, the maturation process. Sexually, the new offenders were performing as adults before they had even outgrown their childhood. Significantly, heightened temptation of a sexual nature in the community did not affect the innocent, but it did affect the knowledgeable. This is why pedophiles and predatory homosexuals find children who have been through sex initiation courses to be far easier prey than innocent children. Whereas the virgin had been the norm for the 1950s, the new type was the norm in the 1970s. Why have they picked the classroom? Well, that's really pretty much a matter of common sense. The classroom offers what no other atmosphere can offer. We have a captive audience composed of extremely immature and vulnerable individuals in a controlled environment for an extended period of time, including the two critical periods, the critical latency period between the ages of 5 and 6 and the onset of puberty, and the general educational period between the ages of 5 and 15 years of age, when the child is extremely educatable and malleable. Then you have the case of parendectomy, that is, the child is separated from the parent and the natural protection of the family in the classroom. This process of conditioning follows a threefold pattern. First, the child has to be desensitized, and there's a breaking down of his morals and behavior. In the words of a sex initiation advocate, a man by the name of Dr. Robert Harper, By the time children reach kindergarten, they are already damaged goods. Now, what does he mean by that? He said that by the time they reach kindergarten, children already associate sex with family, marriage, and babies. And therefore, it is necessary that they undergo reconstructive psychotherapy. Second, the second process is a habituation and exposure to the new paradigm shift in sexual morality and practices, with emphasis on contraception, abortion, and eugenics, with population control, the essence of the former, and quality control, the essence of the latter. Then there is the final phase. The final phase involves the restructuring and integration of the new value system into the life of the child or the youth. That is why it takes 12 years instead of the normal 15 or 20 minutes, because they are not explaining the facts of life, but they are explaining perversion and the facts of death. That takes much longer. The classroom also provides the authority figure in the person of the instructor. This authority figure can and does exert an undue influence on the child, similar to that of a clergyman or a physician. His very presence in the classroom entails an element of coercion in the child's mind and can be very effective in undermining parental authority and beliefs. This is particularly true in this area of sexual education, because this presence of an authority figure is lacking on the playground or behind the barn door in private conversations that the child might have with his or her peers. Such encounters, however crude or coarse we might consider them, retain the elements of a secret between friends and cannot be considered as sexual conditioning. Given the very open and public nature of the classroom, the very intimate, transcendent, and private nature of the sexual sphere is easily transformed, deformed, and desacralized. The great mystery of the sexual union, which religion has traditionally shrouded with a veil of reticence, is torn asunder. It has been Dr. Anschel's observation of drug education, and here I would substitute sex education, that such programs are really an inducement to drug use and to precocious sexual activity. He says that we know that systematic drug education increases student drug use, and systematic classroom sex education, so-called, increases sexual activity among the young. Everything one could possibly want to know about drugs or sex is taught to the students in these knowledge-based centers, morally neutered, and we know that when normal young people are instructed about a societal taboo by adult authorities, many youngsters will be drawn to experiment with that activity. With regard to the sex educators themselves, most of whom, pity them, have also undergone some degree of sexual attitudinal restructuring before they are turned loose on their students. With regard to these individuals, it seems somewhat ironic, but it is very true, that the more innocent appearing and charming the teacher, the more effective the brainwashing. Thus, the figure of a overtly obnoxious slob, like, for example, Saul Gordon, King of Sleaze, Piper of sex education, so-called, is not as effective in conditioning the children as, let's say, a matronly figure like Mary Calderon, the head of CECUS, or the pert, lovely, lithe figure of a Pat Miller, narrator of the Franciscan sex series In God's Image. Not surprisingly, the much-touted right to privacy appears nowhere on the scene except to rationalize a woman's right to abortion. On the contrary, the youth is forced through various values clarification techniques to submit what Dietrich von Hillebrand has called his secret self to the group, and he has to prepare himself for possible group humiliation and self-abasement. Absolution is rendered by his peers. The child is desensitized to the intimacy and the sacred nature of the marital act. The lowest common denominator of sexual morality carries the day. After all, sex initiation courses put virtue at a disadvantage and favor the sexually sophisticated and promiscuous. With regard to lack of teaching of modesty and purity, Father Bill Smith, my friend formerly from Dunwoody, once said of the American Bishops' Sex Ed Guidelines, 1981, that if you held your breath between the mention of the word virtue, you would asphyxiate yourself. One of the key points to understanding the destructive nature of so-called classroom sex education is a point which we as adults fail to remember, and that is children are by nature children. They are not mini adults. They are immature, hence their name. And children are keen observers, but they are poor interpreters. It is not unusual for young children in particular, when exposed to audiovisual materials simulating coitus, to view it as an act of aggression against the woman and not as an act of love. In the New Creation series, where you have overheads of the male and female reproductive systems, you will see that the camera or the audiovisual equipment is focused on the ceiling, and they'll have the female reproductive tract, the male reproductive tract, and then they are moved together to simulate sexual intercourse. It's very interesting that these individuals can't even get their biology right. On the New Creation series, they indicate that the anus, which is part of the alimentary canal and therefore part of the digestive system, is part of the reproductive system. And that is, of course, to demonstrate to the students the act of sodomy. From a strictly spiritual perspective, the French writer Claude Tremonton said of bad catechetics, and this would apply to what William Brown calls the new sexual catechesis, that it would be more merciful to drop a bomb on the children, since the latter results purely in their physical destruction or physical death, while the former results in interior and spiritual destruction and annihilation. As he observes, one can massacre children in many ways. You can depress them, you can demean them, you can degrade them, you can turn them from their end, which is Christ our Lord. And that under the influence of the teaching of giving them a vision of the world as one sees it. Along these lines, one can degenerate children. In the 30 years that I've been involved in fighting so-called sex education, which, by the way, Alan Guttmacher, back in 1973, called the means by which abortion would stay secure, the thing that is always puzzling to me is how can parents tolerate such a behavior, not only in the public schools, but more importantly, in the parochial schools, because here they actually pay the tuition to have the souls of their children attacked by morally skewed lay teachers or religious or priests. And I often wonder when they surrender their children to Father so-and-so and Sister Moderate-Entity, what do they think Father or Sister is going to tell their children that they don't know? Isn't it strange if there's asbestos found in the school wall You will have a parents' meeting, I guarantee you, that same day, because parents are worried about the physical effects on their children. But in the case of this moral rot, which is robbing the children of their innocence, deforming their consciences, and endangering their eternal salvation, many parents appear to lay down and play dead.